that one fairly vividly, and I thought, you know, that it was chilling. It was important. We played it up a lot, but I also wondered if this was a sort of rhetorical flourish, as these things sometimes are. That is not a rhetorical flourish. You listen to that, and you look at what's happened, and you can see that is the game plan. Whatever they said during the campaign about 2025 is not really, you know, what we're going to do. I think it's turning out. It is exactly what they were going to do. And in particular, that one clip gave us as much of an insight as any into this kind of abstract thing that they say, well, it's a unitary executive. I mean, this is a sort of fairly fringe legal argument that now is at the center of our country, which is that you don't really have any independence in the executive branch. The president leads the executive branch, and therefore he can hire and fire anybody at any time. There are some things where we have a level of norms, right? I mean, generals can get fired. The previous presidents have fired various senior generals, so you can't say that was against the law. But then you have other things like the Consumer Fraud Protection Bureau, Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, CFPB, or the EEOC, which are independent agencies, and laws suggest that you can't just fire the people that run those. And the argument here is, yes, you can. The president is the president. Separation of powers means that everybody who works for the executive branch under any circumstances, inspector generals, you name it, they're all subject to dismissal immediately by the president, since he has what, you know, he himself, I think, is now referring to as king-like powers. And that is what is driving this, and Vogt is an architect of that viewpoint. So I think that clip turns out to be one of the most important things we did in the run-up to the election, far more important even than we understood at the time.
I wanted to ask you also, you've been tracking quite a few of the employees of DOGE. Many of them have not gotten much attention. One of them that you've tracked was a woman by the name of Catherine Armstrong Loving, who's been apparently attached to EPA. She turns out is the sibling of Brian Armstrong, who runs the industry crypto company Coinbase, which, by the way, donated, as you mentioned, $1 million to Trump's inauguration fund. How's this square with Trump's promise to drain the swamp?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we're going to be learning more and more as time goes on. You know, it certainly appears that the hiring of people working for DOGE went through the sort of personal networks of various people, you know, people who worked at Palantir, other kind of Silicon Valley things, people from SpaceX. It is not the slightest surprise, I think, to anybody that some of these folks are going to turn out to be siblings, friends, and allies of various contributors. The problem here, again, is that if you're going to give this group of people absolute power and there is no transparency, how is the public to know, you know, when they stumble slash walk straight into an obvious conflict of interest? I mean, there's so much going on. You know, there was a moment there where somebody found a contract that the State Department was going to buy $400 million worth of Teslas. And then it was quickly sort of erased. And Trump keeps saying, well, we just won't let Elon do anything. It's a conflict of interest. But if you look at the range of his companies and his wealth, it's most of the government. I mean, you know, it isn't just cars. It isn't just rockets. You know, Neuralink is a company that has major sort of oversight from the Food and Drug Administration. And he's trying to, you know, create this you know, cutting edge technology relating to the brain and so on and so on and so on. So, I mean, there's nobody home. They fired the main government ethics officer. I mean, I think that's saying it with words. You talk about draining the swamp as a thing, but let's not look at what you say. Let's look at what you do.
We're going to end with Letitia. Letitia, you are a federal worker with the VA, a very vulnerable population. I mean, the highest in any group of people, the highest number of suicides every day. I hear about the slashing of the LGBT office within the VA. If you could start off, though, by talking about the racial composition of federal workers.
Yes, Amy, that's a great question. So first off, I do want to share that About 30% of our entire federal workforce are U.S. military veterans. And my understanding is that about one in five of all VA employees are veterans as well. So, you know, not only do I serve veterans in my capacity, I work alongside them as well. You know, these veterans are the supporters of their families and bring in income for many of our working families. So it will have a deleterious impact on them. Namely, excuse me, there is a long history of Black workers in the public sector. Since 1861, the federal government has been employing Black workers. As of, well, post-World War II, actually, there were about 150,000 Black workers within the federal government. And these folks were lobbying. They were organizing to make sure that everyone in the federal government had more fair working practices, safer conditions, and stronger collective bargaining rights. Today, 20% of the entire, of all Black workers in the United States of America work within the public sector, earning a living wage, living with more stability, and importantly, receiving life-saving, life-changing benefits. In fact, 25, if I'm not mistaken, 25 or Black workers in the public sector make about 25% more than those in the private sector. So, yeah, this will have a major impact on Black families specifically. Black families cannot afford to lose these jobs. As a predominantly working class population, we have to fight. Resist DOGE in these austerity measures and the larger fight for racial justice and as well as the larger fight to save our democracy.
Tisha, we want to thank you for being with us. Federal worker with Veterans Affairs, member of the American Federation of Government Employees, and Stephen Engelberg, ProPublica editor-in-chief. We'll link to your piece. The Trump administration keeps citing an untrue stat as it targets federal workers and the other pieces that you've been involved with. Coming up next, the private company running the migrant detention center in Guantanamo has a history of abuse. Stay with us.
You gotta find your people, the ones that make you feel all right, the kind you wanna stay up with all night. You gotta find your people, the ones that make you feel whole. They won't leave your side when you lose control, the ones that don't let you lose your soul. You gotta find your people, the ones that get the joke, who understand what you're saying for a word is spoke. You gotta find your people to put the needle in the groove.
Find Your People by Drew Holcomb and The Neighbors. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth's visiting Guantanamo today in his first visit to the notorious naval base since he was confirmed and amidst growing criticism of the transfer and detention of migrants there. On Monday, the Trump administration halted plans to house detained migrants in tent structures at Guantanamo over concerns the facilities don't meet detention standards set by ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The tents lack electricity and air conditioning. Earlier this month, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem visited Guantanamo days after the first detained immigrants were flown there and claimed without evidence that people deported there were dangerous criminals.
These individuals are the worst of the worst that we pulled off of our streets.
Who are they?
Murderers, rapists. So when I was there, I was able to watch one of the flights landing and them unload about 15 different of these criminals. Those were mainly child pedophiles, those that were out there trafficking children, trafficking drugs, and were pulled off of our streets and put at this facility.
So that was Kristi Noem, now the head of the Department of Homeland Security. The New York Times just had an expose on a woman in Colombia who's Venezuelan, who saw her brother in video coming to Guantanamo. And she said, my brother is not a dangerous criminal. He came into the United States. The administration talked about the tattoos, that these people are members of gangs. And she said his tattoos are of Michael Jordan, because he loves Michael Jordan. Well, last week at the Trump, as the Trump administration abruptly deported 177 Venezuelan migrants who'd been detained at Guantanamo, they admitted that 50 of them had no criminal record apart from entering the U.S. unlawfully. Meanwhile, five Senate Democrats, led by Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, sent a letter to President Trump Monday challenging the transfer of migrants to Guantanamo as illegal and unjustified, calling the move, quote, unprecedented, unlawful, and harmful to American national security values and interests, the letter says. It goes on, there's no basis in U.S. immigration law for transferring non-citizens arrested inside the United States to a location outside the United States for detention prior to or for the purpose of conducting removal proceedings, unquote. We turn now to a new investigation that reveals how the private corporation running the migrant detention center at Guantanamo has a history of rights abuses at other migrant detention facilities in the United States. The conglomerate is called Akima. It has over 40 subsidiaries and more than 2,000 contracts with the U.S. government. Last year, the Biden administration awarded a contract to run the Guantanamo Migrant Operations Center to Akima subsidiary. We're joined here in New York by investigative reporter Jose Olivares, whose latest piece for The Guardian is headlined Revealed, U.S. Firm Running Guantanamo Migrant Jail Accused Over Rights Abuses. Jose, it's great to have you with us. Lay out what you found.
Thank you so much, Amy. Yes, so obviously the Guantanamo Naval Base has a long history, and it's notorious for the military prison that has housed war on terror detainees. There's been allegations of torture and abuse there. But what really the public didn't know too much prior to Trump's executive order, is that for decades, there has existed a migrant detention center at the Guantanamo Naval Base. Now, this facility is divided into two. One part of it is run by the State Department, and the other part of it is run by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Now, ICE, what I found is that last year, the Biden administration gave the ICE contract to Acoma Infrastructure Protection, which is this massive, massive federal government contractor. And this contract is worth $163.4 million to run the Migrant Operations Center, which is what it's called. Now, technically, it is at the Naval Base, so it's extremely secretive. We don't know how operations take place, what the conditions are like for migrants there. But what it's what's important to note is that for decades, this facility has been used to detain migrants, primarily those who are fleeing from the Caribbean, trying to make it to the U.S. and are intercepted at sea by the Coast Guard. Now, when they are intercepted at sea, they're sent to the Migrant Operations Center, where they are held and detained and processed, and sometimes either deported back to their home countries or repatriated to third nations. However, what I found with this investigation is that for decades, since the early 2000s, since the Bush administration, private contractors have been running this detention center. First, it started with GEO Group, one of the biggest private prison companies in the U.S. Then it moved to MVM Incorporated, which is a defense contractor. And now last year, the Biden administration gave Acoma this massive contract to run the facility for at least 5 years. What is also important to note here is that because it's on the naval base, it is extremely secretive. So we didn't know that throughout this, you know, various presidential administrations, from Bush to Obama to Trump to Biden, and now under Trump again, migrants have been held at this ICE facility that is at Guantanamo. There's been no public oversight over the facility. There haven't been any public reports, even though they're congressionally mandated by members of Congress to publish reports about the conditions in the facility. But what I also found is that this company, Acoma Infrastructure Protection, is part of a larger conglomerate called Acoma. And Acoma has over 40 subsidiaries. It's a massive, massive company that contracts with the government. And this company also runs other immigration and customs enforcement facilities throughout the U.S. I was able to find at least five of them, and three of them were, you know, really widely criticized for their conditions inside and for the treatment of migrants around the U.S.
And Jose, who runs this company, and how did it manage to gather so many federal contracts? You talk a little bit about its history and its the personalities involved, if any, that you found.
Absolutely. So the history of ECOM is actually quite fascinating. It's a member of the Nana Regional Corporation, which is an Alaskan Native corporation. Now, Alaskan Native corporations were created in the 70s. They were created sort of in response to protests and social movements in order for the federal government to kind of grant indigenous people in Alaska federal contracts and just more opportunities, you know, within their communities. And so the Nana Regional Corporation, it is owned by primarily indigenous people in Alaska. It is an Alaskan Native corporation, so all of the shares, everything is owned by Native Alaskan people. But within the Nana Regional Corporation is ACMA, and within ACMA is these 40, you know, different subsidiaries. And these 40 different subsidiaries have dozens upon dozens upon dozens of federal government contracts. They work with dozens of federal agencies. They work with the Department of Defense. They work with the Department of Interior. They work with ICE. I found one instance in which ACMA, one of ACMA's subsidiaries, it was hired to do maintenance of helicopters in Saudi Arabia for the military, but also to train Saudi military forces. Different IT services, infrastructure. So it's a massive government, federal government contractor. However, because it is an Alaskan Native corporation, the shares for the company can't be traded, they can't be sold. So it's able to sort of escape any sort of regulation from the Securities and Exchange Commission. But because of its status as an Alaskan Native corporation, and because of the 40 subsidiaries that ACMA has, it's able to very quickly get contracts that are supposed to be allocated from the federal government to small businesses. So they're technically a small business that is minority owned, and that's how they're able to sort of get these over 2,000 federal contracts.
And talking again about the Guantanamo Detention Center, what's the situation in terms of detainees, immigrant detainees there, and their access to lawyers?
Yeah, so the access to lawyers is extremely limited, and this has been ongoing, you know, for decades that the migrant detention center has existed at the Guantanamo Naval Base. Now, what's important to note is that the migrant operations center, which is what it's called, is separate from the military prison. But what we do understand from the Trump administration's actions is that migrants who were detained in the U.S. and then sent to Guantanamo for further detention, they were housed both at the military at the military installations, the military prison, and at the Migrant Operations Center. Now, this Migrant Operations Center is divided into two sections. One section is run by ICE, one is run by the State Department, but we just don't know exactly how many people are detained there because of the lack of transparency that, again, spans decades and spans various presidential administrations. Now, I think what's important to note here is that because it is at the naval base, it's in Cuba, right? So migrants who historically primarily have fled from Haiti, from Cuba, from the Caribbean, have been intercepted at sea and then have been sent to the Guantanamo facility for further processing. But we just don't know how many have been sent there. Some estimates that I saw in some of the government contracting records show that between 2021 and 2024, there have been between 4 and 40 migrants who have been detained there. But this Migrant Operations Center, what is interesting about it and what I found with the federal government contracting records is that it has the capacity to hold 120 migrants, 120 people, but ICE requires the contractor to be able to expand the facility with a tent city to detain up to 400 migrants. You know, there's a lot of unanswered questions here. There is a lack of transparency. We don't know what the conditions are like. And because migrants historically who have been detained there have either been deported to their home countries or sent to a third country, we don't hear too much about from the migrants themselves who have been detained there because they primarily really haven't been brought to the U.S.
And would these migrants sent to Guantanamo be counted under deportees because this is area controlled by the U.S. and Cuba? So they're just being sent there, not deported?
Correct. Yeah. So they're still under the custody of ICE and the Department of Defense.
Final question, and we just have about a minute. The human rights abuses that ACMA has been found guilty of.
That's right. So three different facilities have faced severe criticism. There is one facility in Florida called the North Chrome Processing Center, which is owned by ACIMA. And the Department of Homeland Security, the Office of Inspector General, did a federal audit at the facility and found various instances of inappropriate use of force, including one case that I found in which guards at this facility opened the slot to the solitary confinement door of a man who was detained there and pepper sprayed him, despite him showing no resistance or threat to anybody else. There's also a lawsuit for forced labor at the Buffalo Detention Center in upstate New York. And there's also been criticism of one of the solitary confinement units in Texas that it runs.
And finally, 30 seconds, you wrote a piece for DropSite. Biden gave Trump the blueprint to lock up 30,000 migrants in a private ICE jail at Guantanamo Bay.
That's right. Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that this deportation system, this Guantanamo Migrant Detention Center, has been passed down from administration to administration. They're really, you know, from Democrats to Republicans, there has been no significant change between administrations.
Jose Olivares, I want to thank you for being with us, investigative journalist. We'll link to your piece in The Guardian, revealed U.S. firm running Guantanamo migrant jail accused of over rights abuses, as well as your piece for DropSite about Biden giving Trump the blueprint. We'll also do an interview with you in Spanish after the show and post it on our Spanish website at democracynow.org. Next up, we look at the nonprofit Dawn filing a complaint with the International Criminal Court against Biden, Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Austin over Israel's war in Gaza. Stay with us.
I said I love the lie the love, hanging on with push and shove. Possession is the motivation. Whole damn nation, looks like we always end up in a rut, trying to make it real, but compared to what? Slaughterhouse is killing hard.
Roberta Flack, the well-known Grammy-winning pianist and singer, died Monday at the age of 88 here in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to an effort to hold the Biden administration accountable for their role in Israel's war in Gaza. The D.C.-based nonprofit Dawn has formally asked the International Criminal Court to investigate former Secretary of State Antony Blinken, former Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and President Joe Biden for their, quote, accessorial roles in aiding and abetting, as well as intentionally contributing to Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza, unquote. These crimes include those identified in the ICC's arrest warrants issued last year against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. We're joined right now by Reed Brody, well-known veteran war crimes prosecutor on the board of Dawn. Can you explain the significance of this suit as we speak to you in Geneva, Switzerland, Reed?
Sure. As you said, Amy, in November, the ICC issued warrants against Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant for starvation as a method of warfare, for intentionally directing attacks against civilians, for the crime against humanity of murder and of persecution. But they didn't act alone. And under the ICC statute, you can also be held liable for aiding and abetting a crime. And in order to do that, you have to have assisted in the commission of a crime with knowledge that the crime was being committed or was going to be committed in the ordinary course of events. And that's what we say that Biden, Blinken, and Lloyd Austin did here. I mean, the bombs that Israel has used to destroy schools, hospitals, and homes in Gaza were American bombs that they provided. Israel's campaign of murder and persecution was carried out with political support that they ensured. And these officials were aware, as we explain in the complaint, that Israel was committing these crimes, and yet they ensured that the political, diplomatic, and military support continued. You know, our submission has 172 pages. It shows in detail how Biden, Blinken, and Lloyd Austin ensured that you know, $17.9 billion in military assistance was sent, how real-time intelligence was given, how the U.S. vetoed resolutions at the UN Security Council. And we show how, in many instances, these officials actually overruled people below them who said, you know, war crimes are being committed. You can't, under American law, under international law, you know, provide this assistance. But I think our submission shows that Biden, Blinken, and Austin are not only morally and politically complicit, but they're legally complicit.
Reid, has there been any precedent in terms of the aiding and abetting of provision in the past before the court?
Absolutely. I mean, our case is based on very solid precedents. The best example is the case of Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, who was convicted by the special court of Sierra Leone for aiding and abetting the rebels in Sierra Leone, you know, the ones who cut off people's hands, arms, a country that he never set his foot in. And they said Charles Taylor was aware of the crimes that were being committed by his Sierra Leonean allies, and yet he continued to give them arms and he continued to encourage them. What I like to say is, imagine that a gunman is on a killing spree, and he runs into a store. The owner knows what the man is doing. He said, quick, I need more ammunition. And the owner says, here, but be careful how you use it. That's the situation we're in. These officials were aware of what was being done with their ammunition, except in our case, they also tried to stifle criticism of what the gunman was doing, and they did it again and again.
And Reid, you filed this under an Article 15 submission. What is that precisely?
So under Article 15 of the ICC's governing Rome statute, NGOs, individuals, victims can provide information to the ICC prosecutor. Now, the ICC prosecutor already has an investigation open into the crimes committed by Hamas and committed by Israeli officials. So this will go into that. You know, the prosecutor does not usually talk about what he does with his investigation. We know that investigation is ongoing. And what we're saying is, don't just go. I mean, we're hoping that, of course, other individuals in the theater are named. But we also say, look at the people behind them. Look at the people who have aided and abetted this.
Reid, earlier this month, President Trump signed an executive order authorizing sanctions against the ICC over its war crimes investigations against Israel. Dawn
Absolutely.
Has stated that Trump's order against the ICC could subject him to, quote, individual criminal liability for obstruction of justice. Can you explain what that's about and what you're asking for regarding Trump as well?
Sure. Well, we didn't ask for it in the communication, but as you say, under Article 70 of the ICC Rome Statute, if it criminalizes and as an offense against the administration of justice, what we Americans call obstruction of justice, to, for instance, retaliate against a court officer for taking action. So here the prosecutor has indicted Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Trump administration has responded by levying sanctions on this man and on the court. So that really sets—I mean, the prosecutor would be well within his rights to open up an investigation of Donald Trump for these sanctions, as he would, incidentally, for the 9 years that Israel tried with three successive prosecutors to blackmail, harass, and sting them to prevent them from taking these actions.
Reid Brody, we thank you very much for being with us. Veteran war crimes prosecutor, board member of Dawn, the nonprofit which has filed the communication with the ICC prosecutor over the role of U.S. officials, Biden, Blinken, and Austin, in supporting Israeli war crimes in Gaza. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Pels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Anjali Kamath, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-900-1010.
With 1.5 million Canadians identifying as blind or having low vision, what will the future look like as we move to a world where using our eyes for screen time is at an all-time high? The BC Yukon Division of the Canadian Council of the Blind, or CCB, is a group run by the blind for the blind, where sports and recreation, technology training, and peer support are just a few of what they offer. To find out more, visit ccbbcyukon.com.
This is